This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. This summer, a movement called hashtag Bank Black encouraged those protesting police brutality to move their money to Black-owned banks. Now, those banks are reporting a huge boost. Thousands of new accounts opened and a growth in assets amounting to about $6 million. Rapper Killer Mike is credited with popularizing the hashtag earlier this summer. Here he is in an interview with Hot 107.9. He's urging listeners to take immediate action.
You can go to your bank tomorrow and you can say, until you as a corporation start to speak on our behalf, I want all my money. Right. And I'm taking all my money to Citizens Trust. Right now, and I ain't saying march, whole hand speech. I'm saying take your money out of this dog's hands, out of their paws. Take your money.
Killer Mike's bank, Citizens Trust, is based in Atlanta. It's one of only 23 Black-owned banks, credit unions, or savings and loan associations in the United States. Today, we're looking back at the historical intersection of race and banking and asking, will this movement boost prompt long-term growth? Joining our discussion is Terry Williams, president of One United Bank, the largest Black-owned bank in the country. Terry, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Mirza Baradaran, professor of law at the University of Georgia and author of How the Other Half Banks. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Terry Williams, what has this recent infusion of cash meant for your bank?
It has been a significant infusion in terms of deposits. And what it really has meant is that the Black community is finally starting to recognize the power of our spending dollars. We spend about $1.2 trillion a year in annual spending, and most of that spending is spent, actually only 2% of it or so, is actually spent in the Black community, which makes it very difficult for us to, you know, build wealth and to grow Black-owned businesses.
And Black banks aren't new, of course. They've been around for a long time. But overall, they are struggling. There are far fewer banks like yours now, even than there were before the financial collapse of 2008. So is this latest movement something significant that can help bring the power of Black banks back, do you think?
The short answer is yes, but I also just want to sort of clarify the struggling that's been happening in the Black banking sector. Part of that was a result of the recession, but part of that was really a result of a need to invest in technology. And a lot of the Black-owned banks were small and just didn't have the resources to invest in online banking and mobile banking and bill pay. And so that I'd call it that journey of having to move to a much more technologically based industry is one in which we did lose some of our Black-owned banks. But I think the ones that are remaining that you can see do have that technology are actually here to stay.
Professor Mirza Baradaran, where historically has been the economic power of Black banks? I mean, checking and savings is fine, and that's one thing for a community bank. But the real economic power of banks, of course, is in mortgages and lending, larger lending, business lending, and counteracting the kind of discrimination historically that African Americans have experienced when trying to bank in white-owned corporate banks.
This industry has ebbed and flowed through time, and often you see the industry rise after there's a significant hardship, right? So you've got an industry that's responding to discrimination and segregation. And so when you've got, you know, say the Great Migration or some of the, you know, civil rights movements, you see this rise in Black banks. So it's an industry that's been robust, but back and forth through time. These institutions that are needed to help communities escape poverty, as Terry was saying, you know, there's this wealth gap, and Black banks are really at the center of trying to do this. They are the engines of wealth growth in the Black community. But often these engines end up being victims of that same poverty. So it's the same sort of catch-22. As she said, they're small banks. They have a hard time catching up with technology. And that's exactly because the sort of circumstances that fuel their development also end up causing their demise.
Terry Williams, I mean, part of the professor's point there is that the point of Black banks in the first place was to counteract a long legacy of things like redlining, housing discrimination, predatory lending. But if you grow up within that ecosystem, it's hard to grow to a point where you can fight back against that kind of discrimination.
You know, it's sort of interesting. I mentioned how technology really caused the demise of some of the smaller banks, but I also think it is going to actually allow the remaining banks to prosper. Because one of the challenges that we've had as a community, as you're exactly right, it's how do we serve the community while at the same time, you know, remain, you know, safe and sound. And one of the ways that technology helps that is that there are actually African Americans that don't directly live in the low to moderate income communities that we serve, whose dollars, whose deposit dollars could really help us serve those communities. And technology allows those individuals who are either African-American or allies of the African-American community to deposit money into these Black-owned banks, which gives us low-cost funding that allows us to do the type of lending that is necessary for these banks to grow.
Right. I mean, this means that anyone who can read a hashtag from wherever they are or hear about one can get on the internet or get on an app and put money in your bank.
Right. And it's, you know, FDIC insured. Our rates are, you know, competitive rates. And, you know, as we always say to people, it's still your money, you know, so it's not like it's a, you know, contribution. It really is a deposit. But what it does is it provides lower cost funding to, you know, Black-owned banks, which allows us to offer the lending services that we need to offer to these communities.
Professor Baradaran, I wonder if infusions of $6 to $10 million like we've seen, while that's impressive, how far that really goes in a world where, you know, Terry's Bank is going up against Wells Fargo or Citibank, giant corporations. Is that a significant amount of cash in the real world? And how much more would this technologically driven movement need for a bank like Terry's or other Black banks to really start to compete in ways that are that make an impact in the community?
The question I want to answer is, will these banks make a dent in the wealth gap? I think the answer is they will try, and they're the only ones trying, but that it takes a lot more than these banks. And just as an example, I mean, you've got, this is an industry that's been going since, like I said, the Civil War, before Abraham Lincoln is assassinated, the month before he's assassinated, he signs into law the Freedmen's Savings Bank. That's the first Black bank, and it was Frederick Douglass was its president later. But, you know, as it turned out, those funds just disappeared, right? And so throughout history, there's been these Black banks, many over time. There's 20 now, but before the Great Depression, there were 135 Black banks across the country, really robust sector. And what I've seen through studying these banks over time is that unless the bigger conditions change, unless we are not segregated, unless there isn't a wealth cap, these banks alone can't bridge that gap.
So Terry Williams, what's next for you and One United Bank? There's this movement, there's Bank Black, $6 to $10 million on the way in, some attention from your community and from the media. What's next?
Our next step is to continue this movement, to really push people to not only move their money, but to change their mindset, to move their mind, as we're calling it, and start to realize that, you know, that Black money matters, and that this is part protest in terms of taking money out of large institutions and putting them in Black-owned banks. But it's also, you know, part progress, and that we need, as the Black community, we need to focus on our money. We need to be financially responsible. We need to figure out how to buy from Black-owned businesses. We need to figure out how to bank Black. We need to figure out how to move our community. There have been studies to show that if we could increase the amount of business that we give to Black-owned businesses, we could create 1 million jobs in the Black community. So we need to do that. Something we can do on our own without government support, without anybody's support. So what we need to do is what we can do, what we have control over, what positive steps we can take. And I think when we take those steps, I think others will come around. And I think that, you know, this is the beginning of the movement. Anytime you have a movement, you know, it always starts and trickles, but then it grows. And that's what we're seeing.
Terry Williams is president of One United Bank, and Mirza Baradaran, professor of law at the University of Georgia and author of The Color of Money, A History of Black Banking, out in 2017 from Harvard University Press. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Paul in Bountiful, Utah. My wife is Black and I am white. We noticed that after a while, when we were taking in exactly parallel transactions involving the exact same bank accounts, we were being treated differently by the bank. My wife was always asked to come into the bank instead of completing the transaction in the drive-thru, and she was asked to show ID, whereas I was never asked to do either.
We've been asking you, have you ever experienced discrimination in banking because of race? From Grand Prairie, Texas, yes, Bank of America suspended my account overnight on a Friday without notice because, quote, their records could not verify that I was a U.S. citizen or that I lived in Texas. Even though I've lived in Denton, Texas, I've been a U.S. citizen and I've never left the country. Once I looked into it, they simply told me that they had to confirm the location of their Iranian-American members, hence the suspension.
This is Nancy calling from Fort Worth. I currently experience discrimination at my credit union due to disability, even though I have federally mandated accommodations, which simply support humane treatment. This is yet another pervasive civil rights problem.
We got this from Clinton, New Jersey. I've walked into banks stoned out of my mind where I was giggling like an idiot and never gotten even a dirty look. I'm a white male.
Leah Kurzer calling from Brooklyn, New York. We have experienced discrimination at the Bank of America. We are Orthodox Jews. We feel as though the bank does not care for our business. When trying to speak with a bank officer, he spent time with people of other races, and he ignored us.
And from Concord, California, I've been discriminated against for all kinds of things at several banks just because I'm female or because I'm not married. Right now, I'm trying to get a loan to get out from under a big, nasty bank and refinance my home and pay off my ex-husband. They discriminate against you if you're self-employed as well, so it doesn't surprise me if they discriminate against race. I appraised at twice the value of what I owe.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.